This is a commercial-free archive edition of our live radio show that airs every Friday at noon Arizona time on OpenMinds.tv.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas, former official spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network. Alejandro has been a UFO paranormal researcher and journalist for nearly a decade and has logged hours in the field investigating the paranormal up close and personal. And now Open Minds Radio presents evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hello and welcome to Open Minds Radio, where we're bringing the UFO subject into the light of day. This is Alejandro Rojas, and we have another spectacular show today. I always get so excited to speak to you people. Today we have, who we were supposed to have last week, Dr. Paul Davies. Unfortunately, you know, we had a phone issue last week, and luckily he was able to reschedule, but still a lot of people appreciate it hearing me and Jason go over the news for the show, and there's always so much interesting stuff to talk about in this field, and today we're going to be talking about a lot of really cool stuff with a skeptic. Yes, Mr. Paul Davies is a skeptic when it comes to UFOs and possible extraterrestrial presence here on Earth. However, because of him, this subject has been in the news a lot. Paul Davies has a new book coming out that's called The Eerie Silence. It's kind of about SETI and what they're doing to look into UFOs and extraterrestrials. And he also spoke at the Vatican recently and the Royal Society's Conference on Astrobiology, all of which has been getting a lot of news across mainstream media, so all about extraterrestrials. Here's his bio, which is really interesting. Paul Davies is a British-born theoretical physicist. He's a cosmologist, astrobiologist, and best-selling author. He is the director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science and co-director of the Cosmology Initiative at Arizona State University, although he's all over the world talking on these subjects. As I mentioned, he spoke at the Vatican, and this was at the Pontifical Academy for Sciences Study Week on Astrobiology, and at the Vatican, the Royal Society's recent conference on astrobiology, and it had kind of a cool name. It was called The Detection of Extraterrestrial Life and the Consequences for Science and Society. So that title is just kind of cool to have some major organization out in the UK, some stuffy scientist organization talking about this stuff. So we're going to be talking to Dr. Davies about all of this and more. Of course, we talked a lot about how Hillary Clinton was holding Dr. Davies' book when she was meeting with Lawrence Rockefeller, who was trying to get the Clinton administration to release information on UFOs. So we'll talk about that as well. Exciting breakthrough when we finally figured out what the book was that she was holding in their meeting. Otherwise, a little bit of business before we get into the news. Our magazine, Open Mind Magazine, is in the stores. I've been telling you people that it's been in every store, but, you know, we've got this girl who works with us, Maureen, who's always got to burst our bubble. Thanks, Maureen. Just kidding. She actually does a lot of cool stuff for us. Now she's back there just berating me in the corner. But luckily you can't hear her. But actually, we're not in every bookstore for the first run, but we will be for the second. So it's only select Barnes & Nobles and Borders bookstores out there that you can get it. But you can always go to openminds.tv and order it. You've got very friendly service, and there's lots of cool stuff to see there on the website while you're ordering. However, this next edition, which is coming out June 1st, which it has a lot of Vatican stories in it, including a story from the Jesuit's ex-lawyer. I forget exactly what his title was, but essentially someone who worked for the Jesuits, a story on the Vatican and ETs and UFOs and all that cool stuff. So the next magazine will be out soon, June 1st in all the stores. We've gotten a lot of great feedback on the magazine. Also, locally. And if you want to fly out here to Scottsdale, Arizona, you can come and meet the editors of Open Mind magazine, which includes myself. And we'll be talking about our stories at Vision Quest Metaphysical Bookstore. That will be April 30th at 7 p.m. And they are at 2225 North Scottsdale Road. So that will be a lot of fun. And then finally, join us in Roswell. And we'll have a lot more information on that coming up. July 4th in Roswell, come and see the fireworks. Hopefully we won't accidentally cause another UFO crash with the fireworks out there. But Roswell has a big festival on the 4th of July weekend to commemorate the alleged crash of a UFO back in 1947. So that'll be a lot of fun, and we'll be there. But before we get to our guest, let's get into UFOs in the news. And, of course, as always, we have our news correspondent, Jason McClellan. Jason, tell us all about the news, Mike.
Good afternoon, Alejandro. Hello, Phoenix, and hello, world. This is your Open Minds news brief for Friday, April 23rd, 2010. In the news this week, NASA's planet-hunting probe, known as Kepler, may have found 400 Earth-like planets, but don't expect NASA to share any details for a while. NASA has procedures in place for sharing research data, but details related to the 400 objects of interest, as they've been called, were sealed from the public by a NASA panel until at least February 2011. The panel cited a need to study the planets more closely as their reason for sealing the information.
Yeah, kind of weird. I mean, they've been looking for extrasolar planets and those that possibly have life for a long time, and it's been all supposedly being shown to the public. Why all of a sudden do they say they've got to keep this stuff secret? Very strange.
It is strange.
And they didn't give an answer as to why.
Right.
They just said, we're doing it.
They just want to do it. They think they need more time, but it's interesting because they don't usually do that.
Yeah.
Strange. But if any NASA officials are listening and they do find something really cool about these planets, February 2011 is when they say they're going to release the data, and that's perfect time for our International UFO Congress.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully, and if they wanted to, and we should give them this offer, they can come down to the UFO Congress and release their information there.
We can certainly make that happen.
Right.
Absolutely. In other science news, Gary Rufkin, a professor of genetics at Harvard University, has developed a microfluidics chip that could be used in the future to sift Martian soil for alien DNA. The chip would be installed on a soil-collecting rover vehicle and would cause any microscopic life within the Martian dust to release its genetic material. Chemicals in the chip would then amplify the DNA and label it with fluorescent dyes. Rufkin estimates his team is only 3% complete with designing a workable Martian DNA sequencing machine. But still, the thought is pretty cool.
Yeah, cool. You know, put that baby in a rover and be interesting to see what they find.
Yep. On TV this week, the History Channel is running a series entitled Ancient Aliens. The series explores the evidence of ancient aliens and looks at the ancient alien theory, a notion fathered by Swiss author Eric von Daniken. According to the theory, space travelers visited Earth thousands of years ago, and they taught humans about technology and influenced ancient religions. Ancient Aliens airs Tuesdays at 7 p.m. Arizona time on the History Channel, and I believe they air reruns on Saturday nights, so check your local listings. Also in the news, our guest today, Paul Davies, his new book, The Eerie Silence, Renewing Our Search for Alien Intelligence, was reviewed in the New York Times this week. Adding to the tremendous amount of mainstream press Professor Davies has already received during the past couple of months.
Yeah, he's gotten just mega press all over the place.
I'm excited to have him on the show today.
I know, me too.
That's it from the news. Remember to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm your Open Minds news correspondent, Jason McClellan, and you've been briefed. Back to you, Alejandro.
All right. Yes, when we get Paul Davies on in just a few minutes here after our next commercial break, which is coming up in a few seconds, we will be talking about SETI. He used to be a backer of this group, and we'll talk more about who and what they are if you're not familiar. But he says there's probably better ways to do what they're doing, which, of course, we felt all the time. We'll be talking about the Vatican and Hillary Clinton with Paul Davies when he comes back after this break. Hello and welcome back to Open Minds Radio. This is your host, Alejandro Rojas, and we've got a little bit of a delay with Paul Davies getting online. He'll be here very soon. But one thing I wanted to mention about him, which is kind of cool, and maybe Jason, if you can share your comments as well, but this is a guy who has an asteroid named after him. In 1992, officially OG-6870, I think is the name of the asteroid, was renamed Paul Davies in his honor. How cool is that?
I did not know that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, one of the things I want to talk to him about also is, which is interesting that he spoke at the Vatican, because he talked about Christianity having the biggest issue. And what's interesting is this was just prior to the Vatican having their astrobiology conference. So I'm wondering if it has something to do with them doing this. But that Christianity, out of all the religions, really has kind of the hardest problem philosophically with the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence, and mainly because, like he talks about, is a second Genesis, that this idea that when Jesus died, he died to save humankind. So if there are others out there, did he die for them as well? Did he go talk with them? Did he reincarnate? But really, Christianity doesn't allow for the idea of reincarnation. So a lot of issues there that they're looking into.
The series that's running on the History Channel right now, The Ancient Aliens, also dives into ancient religions. And a lot of what Eric Mondanikin talks about is religion and aliens playing into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that there are a lot of ancient religions and cultures, or at least, you know, a lot of cultures don't have that whole concept of religion, but it's more of philosophy or origin stories, where they came from. And a lot of them refer to origin stories where they come from the stars. But it looks like we do have Dr. Davies on the line, so let's bring him up. Hello, Dr. Davies, are you there?
Yes, hello. Sorry for the technical hiccup.
No problem. We had a bigger technical hiccup last week, so at least we got you on. Thank goodness. It's wonderful to hear from you, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure.
But I guess let's start off. We'll start up, you know, the show. We had sent you some information about Hillary Clinton and your book. We'll get into that later on, and also the Vatican. But I really want to start off with your new book, The Eerie Silence, and some of what you're going into there. And really, you're talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, which I know you had some involvement with in the past, and how there may be better ways to be looking for intelligent life other than the radio signal way that they're using.
Yes, it's 50 years ago this month that Frank Drake, a then little-known American astronomer, decided to start sweeping the skies with a radio telescope in the hope of stumbling across a message from ET, and this is known as SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It's got nothing to do with UFOs or anything of that sort. It's a thoroughly scientific search that now involves scientists in many countries, and it seemed to me that after 50 years of receiving nothing but an eerie silence, maybe the time had come to take stock and ask whether we can improve on what they've been doing, maybe search for ET in other ways, and not just leave it to a small band of radio astronomers. So my book, The Eerie Silence, is both a celebration of their heroic effort, but also an opportunity to inject some new thinking into this field.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of these methods that you think they can improve upon in their search?
A lot of people, I think, are familiar with this subject through the movie Contact, which was based on a novel by Carl Sagan. And that supposes that there is an alien community somewhere out there that's deliberately beaming messages at us. And the problem with that is that the nearest such community, even if you ask a wild optimist, is likely to be hundreds of light years away, let's say 1,000 to take a round figure. And because nothing travels faster than light, anybody living 1,000 light years away is going to see Earth as it was 1,000 years ago. And there were no radio telescopes on Earth at that time. So there's no reason that they should be sending messages directly at us. And so looking for those sorts of messages, I think, is pretty hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we could look for beacons, for example. Imagine being a lighthouse keeper. You're sending out a beam of light, sweeping around in all directions. You don't expect to get a reply. It's a one-way type of thing. It's a beacon
right.
that just says hello or avoid this place or come to this place. And we could look for radio beacons in the galaxy that some advanced civilization may have set up a long time ago. Maybe this is now a long-vanished civilization left as a monument or something. But that requires a rather different type of technique from what the SETI astronomers are using at the moment. So it's just one way that we might extend the search. There are many other ways suggested in the book as well.
Right. Some people suggest that there are some dangers around that. In fact, I was watching a television show recently where this scientist figured out how to send out signals, and he was really excited, and he was telling everybody, hey, I'm sending out a greeting to aliens and extraterrestrials out there. And then the next scene, there's this civilization that says, we're getting a signal from this planet out here. And they say, okay, let's go conquer it and steal their resources, kind of. And some of the people say there is maybe a danger to sending out these signals. Do you believe in that?
No, I don't. I don't for one moment. And there are two things I should say. One is that the SETI program doesn't send signals. It just listens.
Mm-hmm.
But a few people have sent signals. I was actually involved myself in a sort of gimmick of that sort recently. There's no danger at all because you said it yourself that maybe they'll come here for our resources. But they would already know about our resources. They don't
right.
need us to tell them. In other words, if they're that advanced, they will have been observing Earth. What you have to understand in this game is that Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There were stars and planets around billions of years before Earth even existed. So if there are alien civilizations popping up all the time around the galaxy, some of those will have been around for an immense period of time. We're not just talking thousands of years. We're talking 10 million, 100 million, a billion years. And so during that time, there's been plenty of time for them to come and take Earth if they wanted it. This was an argument used long ago by the famous physicist Enrico Fermi. It's often called the Fermi paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Where is everybody, he said. He realized that the aliens had plenty of time to come here if that's what they wanted to do. And so they don't need us to tell them. There's no particular reason they should come here now just because we're here.
Right.
When they could have come at any time in the past. Humans mm-hmm. have only been around in a communicative phase for a very short period of time.
You just mentioned how you were involved with a project with sending out messages, and that did get a lot of press. It seems like a lot of what you're doing is getting a lot of press. What were the sort of messages? And I saw these news stories, and they were kind of titled, The Guy Who's Going to Speak to E.T. What were the nature of the messages that you sent out?
These were just from young people. We did a Twitter campaign. We said as part of when I was launching my book in the U.K., it was UK Science Week, and so just to get young people interested in science, we invited them to submit messages, and then we picked the best of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And these were really just, homespun philosophy. There wasn't anything terribly profound, and it wasn't intended as a serious attempt, because we have no
right.
idea where to point the telescope. We don't know where any extraterrestrial civilization might be. Now, the rules of the game would change dramatically. Of course, if we picked up a signal, if we find that there is a transmitting source at a particular place in the galaxy, then that's different. Then we have to be very, very careful. And I think I chair something called the SETI Post-Detection Task Group, and it's our job to think ahead. What happens if ET calls on my watch? What do we do next? And
mm-hmm.
one of the things we don't do next is tell everybody where in the sky this source is, so any crackpot can commandeer a radio telescope and start blasting away with their own homespun philosophy, setting themselves up as a spokesperson of mankind
right.
before we've had a chance to properly evaluate what we're dealing with. And
mm-hmm.
so that's one thing I think we're all agreed on.
Mm-hmm. So have you discussed and philosophized on what type of messages you would send to such a group?
Yes, and in my book I go into this in quite some detail, because the way we should look at this is what I often say to my students. Imagine that Earth was going to be wiped out in 10 years, and you have an opportunity to leave a message for posterity, say something about ourselves, about our culture, about our species. What is the thing we most cherish? What is most important? Surely not our physical form. Surely not our sport or politics.
Right.
What are the things that we feel are our greatest achievements? Now, many people would think, you know, the great works of art or literature. But the problem there is that these are hard for people to understand even for other cultures and other species. So we're dealing with beings who've evolved completely separately from life on Earth and whose brains are wired in totally different ways. They're not going to appreciate our art or music. But there's one thing that we do have in common, and that is mathematics. Mathematics is universal.
Mm-hmm.
The statement 11 is a prime number is true whether you're here or on Alpha Centauri. So mathematics is a common currency, a common language, and so are the laws of physics. We assume that if out there is some wonderful transmitter, that they've got technology, they understand basic physics, and the laws of physics are, of course, mathematical relationships. So here we have something we've got in common.
Right.
We can certainly communicate our level of understanding of mathematical physics.
Right.
And so that may sound a bit dull to the average listener, I don't know.
Right.
But it sounds exciting to me. But at least they would think, oh, yeah, they've got as far as, you know, Einstein's equations.
Well, I want to put you on hold for just a second. We've got a break to go to, but we'll talk more about this and messages to extraterrestrials when we come back with Dr. Paul Davies on Open Minds Radio.
This is Open Minds Radio. Here again, your host, UFO paranormal researcher and journalist, Alejandro Rojas.
Welcome back to Open Minds Radio. We are here with Dr. Paul Davies talking about some really cool stuff. We're talking about sending messages to extraterrestrials. And before the break, Dr. Davies, you were talking about sending messages in kind of our common language, which would be math and physics. So what kind of messages would you send, and would it be in hopes to show them that we have an understanding of this common language?
Yes, my feeling is that we should send stuff that from mathematical physics that we're very confident about. That is not, this year's flavor of the month theory. That we should, for example, send the equation E equals mc squared. I think is one that we're pretty confident of.
Mm-hmm.
Simple equation. Now, of course, we have to define what the terms mean.
Right.
And so there are other things that we could send. I don't want to get too technical here, but there are certain pure numbers which don't have any units attached, and you don't need to define them, which would be recognized by any civilization that had got moderate understanding of physics.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are pure numbers which show that we have reached a certain level of development, that we understand quantum physics and atomic physics and so on. And so I would start by sending those numbers. Now, but what you have to understand here is that this isn't a lively two-way conversation that's going to take place. Supposing this civilization is 1,000 light years away, it's going to take 1,000 years for our messages to reach them and 1,000 years for them to reply. So it's not a question of let's sit down and over the next few days educate each other into the way we think and learn each other's language, and then we can have a deeper conversation about other things that we care about, like patriotism or religion or something. You know, that's never going to happen. The only way that would ever happen is if there is some sort of alien probe in the solar system. Maybe it's been sitting here for 100 million years or something, dormant, and then the speed of light issue goes away, because this probe might only be a few light minutes from us, and then it would be possible to have a conversation with the computer on this probe.
And that would lead me to a question. Kind of a lot of the SETI folks feel that it would be impossible to break the speed of light or for something to travel physically those great distances in a short amount of time. Do you feel like that as well?
In this game, you have to take the very best understanding of science, and our best understanding is that the speed of light is an absolute speed limit, and that whatever we discover in the future, that isn't going to change. However, as a scientist, I've learned never to use the word impossible,
mm-hmm.
because, of course, we have no idea whether some dramatic change in our understanding may come along in a few years' time. So it would be very foolish to say that the last word has been said on the nature of space and time. But if we take the attitude, well, we can break all the rules of science, we can throw away the textbooks, then we just get into idle speculation. It then becomes fairy stories, whereas SETI tries to do science. So in other words, why do we even think that there should be intelligent life out there in the first place? Well, that's based on our understanding of biology. So we can't cherry-pick the things we like, namely the biology, and throw out the things we don't like, namely the physics.
Mm-hmm.
So either we're going to be scientific about this, and we take the best science to the best of our understanding and follow through its consequences consistently, or we just throw all of the science out the window and we just tell each other stories. But then that's pretty valueless, I think.
Right. And that sort of brings me to our next area of subject, which is the Vatican and their recent interest in astrobiology. And I've read some of your stories about some of the philosophical issues that their religion, the dogma, would have with the idea of extraterrestrial life. Why do you think they have such a new, renewed interest in this subject?
As a matter of fact, I'm lecturing about this in Berkeley this evening, and so it's a subject dear to my heart. So the first thing to point out is, yes, the Vatican recently had an astrobiology meeting. I was there. It was last November. It was a straightforward scientific meeting. There was no discussion of theology, although it was convened by the head of the Vatican Observatory. And as you probably know, the Vatican Observatory is located in Arizona.
Right.
So in a way, this is a local story, but the headquarters are in Castel Gandolfo, just outside Rome, and the Vatican Academy of Sciences, which is located in the main Vatican territory, is one of the oldest scientific academies in the world, and that was where the meeting took place. And so there's nothing particularly unusual about the fact that they're holding scientific meetings. For example, the one they did before our astrobiology meeting was about genetically modified food. So the function of the Vatican Academy of Sciences, that is made up of non-religious people as well as Catholics, is to inform the Catholic Church on scientific matters about which it might need to make policy decisions. So you see, it's all pretty straightforward. What I don't see in the Catholic Church, somewhat disappointingly, is an interest in the deep theological implications of ET.
Mm-hmm.
For hundreds of years, there was a very lively debate in the church about what to do about sentient beings on other planets. And the problem is this. It's not a problem for other religions, by the way. It's not a problem for Muslims or Jews or Buddhists. It's a real problem for Christians in the following sense, that Christians believe that God became incarnate in the figure of a human being, namely Jesus Christ, in order to save a particular species, namely humans. So Christians don't believe that Jesus Christ came to save the chimpanzees or the whales or the dolphins, or for that matter, the Neanderthals, who were part of the broader family of Homo, but weren't the same species as us, Homo sapiens. You see, the difficulty is that if there are advanced alien beings who are ahead of us, not just scientifically and technologically, but maybe ethically as well, in some spiritual sense, are more like saintly beings than we are they not to be saved as well? And so there was this long debate in the church between those who wanted multiple incarnations, as a priest, a friend of mine, said, God taking on little green flesh to save little green men, and those who think that that's a deep heresy, that there was the incarnation was unique, it happened only once, one species, one planet, in which case the problem is, what does salvation mean for beings beyond the earth? And the church got itself in a frightful muddle on this, and you'll see all sorts of statements by theologians and religious scientists over the centuries, and then it all went quiet about 50 years ago, and I think it's now in the too-hard basket. I'm trying to kick it out of the too-hard basket. I think the church needs to face up to this and face up to it squarely.
Well, last year, and you're probably aware of this as well, the gentleman who runs the Vatican Observatory, Father Funes, he did come out with something that he wrote in the Vatican Journal that made a lot of news about our space brothers and extraterrestrials, and it's okay to believe in them, and we don't have to be fearful. And he did skirt the issue that you're speaking of now, But I did notice at least some papers and some kind of rebirth of that debate a little bit after he made that mention.
Right, and he was the one who convened the meeting in the Vatican, and as I say, we didn't get into the theological stuff. In my book, I quote his memorable phrase, "The extraterrestrial is my brother." But I have to say that he did skirt the issue, and his predecessor, Father George Coyne, an old friend of mine and a wonderful astrobiologist and astronomer, it was a little bit more upfront. In fact, I can actually quote what he's written on this, if we've just got a moment. He said, God chose a very specific way to redeem human beings. He sent his only son, Jesus, to them, and Jesus gave up his life so that human beings would be saved from their sin. Okay, that's standard. Did God do this for extraterrestrials? Theologians must accept a serious responsibility to rethink some fundamental realities within the context of religious belief. What is a human being? Could Jesus Christ, fully a human being, exist on more than one planet at more than one time? So he's raising the question in a very upfront way, because he's not providing us with an answer.
Right. We do have
at least he's confronting it.
Great. Yeah, we do have to take a small break right now, and then we'll come back to talk more about this. Really interesting, and we do have a chat that goes on where we've got a couple questions there, too, for you. So we'll be right back with Open Minds Radio. We are with Dr. Paul Davies. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Open Minds Radio. Here now, former official spokesperson for the Mutual UFO Network, your host of Open Minds Radio, Alejandro Rojas.
Welcome back. This is Alejandro Rojas. You're listening to Open Minds Radio, and we have Dr. Paul Davies on. And what a great talk. This is a lot of fun, and I want to let everybody know you can get his new book and his other books and see what he's up to at cosmos.asu.edu. The new book, I want to remind you, is The Eerie Silence, and his website is cosmos.asu.edu. So, Dr. Davies, I had to cut you off when you were talking about that quote, but did you get that, you know, that fully out?
I did, yes. I got to the end of the quote.
Perfect.
So I'm simply saying that there are a handful of Christian theologians who these days are prepared to face squarely the dilemma of extraterrestrial beings,
right,
and the problem of the incarnation, which, as I remarked, is not a problem for other religions, I think.
Yeah, and that's why I loved reading about what you had to say about all of that in the past, because I knew there were issues. I grew up as a Roman Catholic, and I knew those philosophies, and I hear those things here and there, you know, even within our community, people debating the philosophies behind that. So, and it does seem like something that at some point they're going to really need to tackle face on, and at least they're kind of touching upon it.
Yes, I think my attitude is that if you think about all the ballyhoo over Darwin's theory of evolution, well, they've had a few decades to sort of come to terms with that. But if we were to get suddenly evidence, incontrovertible evidence, that we're not alone in the universe, this could be very sudden and very destabilizing. And so for those people who care about the future of the Christian religion, they'll have a prepared position at least in case this should happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, someone asked in the chat, and I guess I can preface this with a story from the Royal Society Astrobiological Conference, which I know you attended as well.
I was at that one too, yes.
A friend of ours, Nick Pope, who worked for the MOB investigating UFOs, was also there. And he found it interesting that at lunch and, you know, on off time, a lot of these scientists really were into speculating about all the possibilities of what may be going on right now related to his work. And he found that really fun, and he was surprised how open a lot of these scientists were. Someone in the chat was asking, did you find that same type of atmosphere at the Vatican's conference?
Well, the Vatican conference was a closed conference just for astrobiologists, and I wanted to say right at the outset that astrobiology is almost all not about looking for intelligent aliens. It's about whether there's microbial life on Mars, for example. So it's almost all trying to understand the origin of life on Earth, its astronomical environment, organic molecules in space, those sorts of straightforward technical things. And there was only a small component about SETI. The conference of the Royal Society was a public conference. That is, there was an audience, and so it was not a closed meeting. And so, for that reason, there was a lot more widely varying discussion. So I think these were rather different sorts of meetings.
Right. So you didn't find that sort of behind-the-scenes type of conversation at the Vatican?
No, we had just ordinary scientific sessions and, you know, lunches and dinners and and so on. We didn't need to talk behind the scenes because we could talk openly at the meeting itself. There really wasn't an issue.
So that's what's great. That's what I love about your work, is that you get more into philosophizing around some of these concepts, such as what will it mean if we discover extraterrestrial life,
right,
and even going further into the possibility of intelligent extraterrestrial life.
Absolutely. That's what interests me.
So it was.
And it always has, I might say. I've had an interest in searching for extraterrestrial intelligence ever since Frank Drake started it in 1960. So, you know, I've been in the game for a long time, and I've been closely associated with the SETI program and have written about this and have held workshops at Arizona State University on this topic. And so, you know, I feel I'm a well-wisher and an occasional contributor to the subject.
Right. So did Drake, it was his work that really sparked your interest?
Well, Frank Drake was the pioneer who began this in 1960, and I might say Frank is still in the game.
Right.
I saw him recently at the London meeting. We went out to dinner together. I dedicated my book to him. It says something about the extraordinary vision of the man that after 50 years of searching the skies, hoping to pick up a message from E.T. and getting only an eerie silence, he's nevertheless upbeat about the prospects for the SETI program. So he's a bit of a hero of mine. But the thrust of the book is, alongside doing traditional SETI, looking for so-called narrowband signals coming from specific sources in the sky, we should be greatly broadening the search. And earlier I talked about looking for beacons, but we could look for other things as well, signs of large-scale astro-engineering or any sort of anomaly in astronomy that might stand out and might suggest that it is the footprint of alien technology. We don't have to pick up a message to answer the question, are we alone in the universe? We merely have to see that there's somebody out there doing something. We might not know what they're doing, but it has to be some evidence of some technology at work. And then we could proclaim that, you know, over there at a particular star in a particular direction, there is the footprint of advanced technology.
Now, someone who felt that there was already discovery of the footprint of advanced technology was Lawrence Rockefeller, when he was trying to, with his initiative, get the Clintons really into the subject and looking into secret documents and things like that. And we were excited to find in some pictures, because we thought in this visit that the Clintons made to one of Rockefeller's ranch that they were discussing this topic. And then we found some more evidence of that when, in some of these pictures, Hillary Clinton is holding one of your books, the book.
That's correct, yes. A book called Are We Alone, which I wrote back in the early 90s. It was based on some lectures I gave in Italy. And my first skirmish with this particular topic. It does appear that she's carrying a copy of that book, correct.
Were you aware that the Clintons were aware of your work?
No, it was news to me when somebody sent me a copy of that picture. So, and I haven't had an opportunity to discuss it with Hillary Clinton or anybody else. I have had some exchanges with Lawrence Rockefeller, but not in recent years.
Oh, great. And was he inquiring, just kind of wanting to know about some of your ideas?
Yes, that's right. He was just inviting me to come and sit down and talk about them. But I haven't had that opportunity, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it seems like that would have been, you would have been the type of person that he would want to include in a think tank over, you know, the implications, should he prove what he believed to be true.
Yes, I'm the person. I don't deny it. Of course, I'm involved in many research projects, many big questions. In fact, the center I run at Arizona State University, called the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science, has as its motto, confronting the big questions. So we deal with not just intelligent life in space, but we deal with the origin of the universe and the origin of life and the destiny of mankind and time travel and space travel and you know, a whole bunch of fun stuff. I like to say to people, we research all those things that people love to discuss at dinner parties.
Right. All the fun stuff. And speaking of someone who does the research on this fun stuff, Grant Cameron, who runs presidentialufo.com, he actually has a tight relationship with the Clinton Library, and he sent this information to the Clinton Library secretary he works with, and she sent it, I guess, through a lot of Hillary Clinton's staff. So at least there's some discussion there. So hopefully you'll hear from Hillary when she's got some time.
Well, that's right. If Hillary knows my email address, then there's not the slightest problem. I look forward to hearing from her.
Yeah. So when it comes to these ideas of the possibility that there is some evidence that we have intelligent extraterrestrial contact going on right now, how do you feel about some of that evidence that you've seen?
Well, what I've done in the book is look at it, deal with it very carefully. I think a lot of scientists are just dismissive about the whole UFO scene, and I said earlier that SETI scientists distance themselves from it. Well, I knew Alan Hynek, who was head of the chief scientific advisor of the U.S. Air Force Project Blue Book. I visited him at his home. I looked through many of his reports. We discussed on a number of occasions what was behind these various stories, and he was the one who coined the term close encounters of the third kind.
Right.
I investigated some reports in Britain where I was living at the time, and I think I managed to explain some of them, and I took a great deal of interest in it. And so I deal with that in the book, and I explain why I think this is a different set of problems.
Right.
Unlike many people, I'm not dismissive about people who make who file these reports. I don't think they're just, you know, crackpots and liars. I think they have genuine experiences.
Right, and then people are going to have to read your book to get more information on that, because we are out of time. So thank you so much for being on the show. This is really informational, a lot of fun for me. Next week, we've got Robert Salas on, who was at an Air Force base when nuclear missiles were shut down when UFOs were seen over the base. So it's going to be a great show. Join us next week, and thanks for listening to Open Minds Radio.
I keep forgetting the smell of the warm summer air. I live in a town where you can't smell a thing. You watch your feet for cracks in the pavement.